Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner with 60 minutes of news, views, history, and information. On today's program, I'll have five readings. My featured reading is about wealth from New Yorker magazine. I have a selection about farmers from the Guardian newspaper, information about cancer prevention from Medical Express News, a book review from KirkusReviews.com, and I'm starting with an obituary. Malcolm Jamal Warner, Theo Huxtable on The Cosby Show, dies at 54. This was written by Derek Taylor and Matt Stevens and published in the New York Times newspaper on July 21, 2025. Malcolm Jamal Warner, the actor who rose to fame as a teenager playing Theo Huxtable on The Cosby Show in the mid-1980s, died on Sunday, July 20th, in Costa Rica. He was 54. Mr. Warner apparently drowned while swimming at a beach on the Caribbean coast of Costa Rica near Limon. According to the country's Judicial Investigation Department, the authorities said in a statement that he had apparently been swept away by a strong current and that bystanders had tried to rescue him. The area is popular with surfers. The Cosby Show, which ran on NBC from 1984 to 1992, was a must-see cultural touchstone whose final episode was covered as front-page news in the New York Times. The article began, "Theo Huxtable graduated from NYU yesterday, albeit on videotape, and like a lot of graduations, it was a bittersweet occasion." Mr. Warner, who was 21 at the time, had played the role of the Huxtable's middle child and only son since he was 13. The show's portrayal of an upper-middle-class black family, Bill Cosby and Felicia Rashad played a doctor and a lawyer, raising children in a Brooklyn townhouse, was celebrated as an overdue corrective against harmful stereotypes on television. "It's sad in a way," Mr. Warner said when its run ended. "Our extended family is breaking up. And I can be nostalgic to an extent, but the show for me has always been a stepping stone in my career. It's too early in my career to be nostalgic." Mr. Warner would go on to act in dozens of television shows, including The Magic School Bus and nearly 100 episodes of The Resident, a gritty drama about a group of doctors, as well as a few movies. He co-starred in his own sitcom, Malcolm and Eddie, opposite the comedian Eddie Griffin over four seasons beginning in 1996. In 2011, Mr. Warner stepped into the role of a TV dad himself in the short-lived comedy Read Between the Lines, that's spelled R-E-E-D, opposite Tracy Ellis Ross. Several years later, he played A.C. Cowlings, a friend to O.J. Simpson, in an iteration of Ryan Murphy's anthology series American Crime Story. Mr. Warner also directed episodes of television series, appeared in plays, wrote poetry, and performed music as a bass player. He found success as a spoken word poet, winning a Grammy Award in 2015 for his contribution to the Robert Glasper Experiment's version of the Stevie Wonder classic Jesus Children of America, featuring vocals by Layla Hathaway and a spoken word tribute by Mr. Warner to the victims of the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Connecticut. 2 years ago, he received a Grammy nomination for Best Spoken Word Poetry Album for Hiding in Plain View. Malcolm Jamal Warner was born on August 18, 1970 in Jersey City, New Jersey, to Robert Warner Jr. and Pamela Warner. His family moved to Los Angeles when he was five, he said in an interview with Backstage. Mr. Warner began acting as an after-school activity, he told Backstage, and a national search for Theo Huxtable provided his breakthrough moment. In his audition, he said, he rolled his eyes and played the character with a precocious attitude. Mr. Cosby quickly dismissed that approach, asking him to work on the character and return later. "I thought I had blown it. But I worked on the scene with my acting teacher," Mr. Warner said. "This time when I auditioned, it was real. Mr. Cosby's philosophy is that all humor is based on truth." Millions watched his character negotiate the pitfalls of adolescence and the awkward teenage years. On the show, Cliff and Claire Huxtable, Mr. Cosby and Miss Rashad, also raised four daughters. Sandra, played by Sabrina LaBeouf, Denise, played by Lisa Bonet, Vanessa, played by Tempest Bledsoe, and Rudy, played by Keisha Knight Pulliam. Mr. Warner had a wife and children whose identities he kept private. Complete information on his survivors was not immediately available. Last year, Mr. Warner started a podcast with Candace Kelly and Wesu Baraka, Not All Hood, about the experiences and identities of black people in the United States. He told the Today Show last year that the purpose of the podcast was to create a safe place to share critical points of view. This is a place where we want to be able to discuss all lanes of the black community, he said. This is a place where we can have civil discourse and respectful challenges. But to many people, he would always conjure up memories of the Huxtables. When Mr. Cosby was accused of sexual assault and misconduct by more than 50 women, Mr. Warner lamented what it meant for the legacy of the Cosby Show and its positive depiction of a black family. That's the thing that saddens me the most, he told the Associated Press in 2015, because in a few generations, the Huxtables will have been just a fairy tale. On the most recent episode of Not All Hood, which went up days before his death, Mr. Warner spoke about the challenges black people continue to face in society and recent efforts to de-emphasize the contributions made by black soldiers. So everything that we have to muster, all of our resources, whether it be spiritual, whether it be relational, whether it be political, to whatever extent, he said, everything that we have had to muster just to play on this playing field is what makes us rich as black people. That was the New York Times newspaper obituary for Malcolm Jamal Warner. Theo Huxtable on The Cosby Show dies at 54. This was written by Derek Taylor and Matt Stevens and published July 21st, 2025. My next story is about healthcare. It's from Medical Express News. It's titled, Improving Colorectal Cancer Preventions and Treatment for Black Americans. This was written by Denise Hetty and published July 24, 2025. Despite being one of the most preventable and treatable cancers, colorectal cancer continues to claim more lives in black communities than in any other racial group in the United States. Incidence and mortality rates remain about 20% and 30% higher for black individuals compared with white individuals, making it a leading driver of racial health disparities. A new review co-led by Dr. Folasade May, a gastroenterologist and cancer prevention researcher at the UCLA Health Johnson Comprehensive Cancer Center, provides a deeper look into why these disparities persist and what can be done to eliminate them. Published in Nature Reviews Gastroenterology and Hepatology, the review examines the social determinants of health, such as access to health care, socioeconomic conditions, and systemic inequities that prevent black Americans from receiving timely screening, diagnosis, and treatment for colorectal cancer. Although overall colorectal cancer rates have declined over the past four decades, the decline has been slower among black Americans, resulting in a persistently higher burden of disease, said May, an associate professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and first author of the paper. But for too many people, the chance to avoid a colorectal cancer diagnosis or for a cure if diagnosed just doesn't exist, not because of biological differences, but because of how social and environmental factors influence access to high-quality screening and care. May and her colleagues point to a combination of modifiable risk factors and long-standing social determinants of health as key drivers of colorectal cancer disparities across the United States. These include lifestyle and environmental risk factors such as obesity, lack of access to healthy foods, and low vitamin D levels, lower screening rates due to limited access to care, financial barriers, transportation issues and mistrust of the medical system, poor access to evidence-based and contemporary medical, surgical, and radiation treatments in a timely manner, structural racism that affects everything from provider recommendations to the quality of care available in different neighborhoods and healthcare settings. But these disparities are not inevitable, May noted. The paper also highlights several proven strategies that have already helped close the gap in colorectal cancer outcomes. These include culturally tailored education to raise awareness of colorectal cancer risk and screening options, patient navigation programs to help individuals complete screenings and access care, policies like the Affordable Care Act, which expanded access to preventive care, health system changes, such as automated screening reminders and team-based care, organized efforts in cities, states, and communities that include multi-component interventions to increase screening participation for Black individuals. We found in systems that provide equal access to all eligible users, like the Veterans Health Administration, racial disparities in screening don't exist, said May. Eliminating differences in coverage policy or access to care can help address screening disparities. May and her team emphasize a two-pronged approach to eliminate inequities in colorectal cancer outcomes and to reduce the disease's overall impact. The first step would be to ensure that all individuals have health insurance, regardless of background, and the ability to receive screening and guideline-based treatment. These measures have been shown to improve outcomes within just 5 to 10 years. The second step involves a longer-term commitment to addressing adverse social determinants of health, such as poverty, discrimination, and unequal healthcare infrastructure. By understanding how these factors influence cancer risk and treatment outcomes, researchers and policymakers can develop targeted interventions that create lasting change. This is a solvable problem, May said. We have the knowledge and resources necessary to move beyond reporting inequities to making a generational commitment to resolving these inequities in colorectal outcomes that Black people face. By taking action now, we can save lives today and create a healthier, more equitable future for all. That was the article, Improving Colorectal Cancer Prevention and Treatment for Black Americans. This was written by Denise Hetty and published July 24, 2025, at the website of Medical Express News. Next on today's African American Hour, I have a book review. This is from the website KirkusReviews.com. The title of the book is Black Genius, Essays on an American Legacy, written by Trey Johnson. A spirited presentation of the manifold accomplishments of Black creators as an instrument of resistance and of love. We're utterly amazing, yet Black folks are consistently, persistently, intentionally, conveniently, diabolically left out of conversations about genius all the time. So cultural critic and commentator Johnson observes at the outset of this collection of essays, returning to the theme at several points, as when he writes of sitting in a New Orleans restaurant where everything but the clientele was Black. It all brought up the issues around appropriation, cultural extraction, gentrification, and the sort of dark humor irony of how often our music is good enough, but we aren't. The author's humor is underscored with righteous indignation, as when he writes of going from a private church school where, as Black kids, a lot of us thrived because we had a strong mixture of play, practice, and positivity, prayer too, obviously, to a public middle school and high school, where his abilities were constantly demeaned by white classmates and teachers, calls for his call to pay attention today to young Black students who might have shown up with B or C grades, but had A-plus curiosity and social skills and the ability to think on their feet. Johnson celebrates the Black genius that society throttles through a wide range of examples, from comic books to music, with a lovely remembrance of the peace and love groove of the fifth dimension, and even an understanding word or two for Kanye West, and from comic Dick Gregory to Black Panther. Johnson even closes with a sort of Aquarian evocation of a Black community that is truly communal, one that can afford opportunities to make choices in community with others and minimize some of the additional risk of trying and discovering things on your own. Creating into the future in common cause. Readers will leave this provocative book wanting to hear much more from Johnson. That was a review of the book, Black Genius, Essays on an American Legacy, written by Trey Johnson. This review was published April 15, 2025, at the website KirkusReviews.com. My next reading is about agriculture. The title is United States Department of Agriculture in Support for Black Farmers, Saying It Sufficiently Handled Discrimination. This appeared in the Guardian newspaper and was written by Aaliyah Wright on July 22, 2025. Lloyd Wright isn't shocked that the United States Department of Agriculture is reversing a 35-year-old policy meant to help black farmers in favor of a race-neutral approach. But the 84-year-old who grows soybeans and vegetables in Virginia knows his fellow black farmers will feel the damage. Earlier this month, the agency announced that it's eliminating the term socially disadvantaged, which describes farmers or ranchers who had been subjected to racial, ethnic, or gender discrimination. It includes black, Hispanic, Native American, and Asian groups. The government is going to take back the money, the little bit we were getting, and some of the outreach money will be clawed back, Wright said. Because they're eliminating socially disadvantaged and anything else dealing with DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. The department adopted the language in the 1990 Farm Bill to deliver resources to minority farmers, including through the 2501 program, an initiative that requires the USDA to ensure that historically underserved farmers have access to grants and other resources. Now the agency will drop the use of the term entirely and will no longer consider race or sex-based criteria in its decision-making process for programs. According to the decision, this move will ensure that USDA programs uphold the principles of meritocracy, fairness, and equal opportunity for all participants. The decision also said the department has sufficiently addressed the history of discrimination through litigation that has resulted in settlements, relief, and reforms. USDA officials did not respond to a question about the potential impact this policy will have on programs or on farmers of color, who represent about 4% of the nation's 3.3 million producers according to the Census of Agriculture. However, a spokesperson for the agency said in a statement that Brooke Rollins, the USDA secretary, will follow the law when putting farmers first. Under President Trump, USDA does not discriminate or single out individual farmers based on race, sex, or political orientation. Secretary Rollins is working to reorient the department to be more effective at serving the American people and put farmers first while following the law, the statement said. Several Democratic congressional leaders are speaking out against the change and demanding the USDA be held accountable. Chantel Brown, an Ohio Democratic representative who is a vice-ranking member on the House Committee on Agriculture, said this is Trump's resegregation agenda. Brown said the rule isn't about fairness, but stripping the tools to help level the playing field. It's no secret that the department has a long history of locking out and leaving behind black, brown, and indigenous farmers, Brown wrote in a statement. Now this administration is taking a deliberate and disgraceful step backward on the path to attempt to right the historic wrongs. The socially disadvantaged designation was a long overdue recognition of the barriers to land, credit, and opportunity that farmers of color have faced for generations. Shamari Figures, a Democratic representative of Alabama, who also serves on the House Committee on Agriculture, said that instead of reversing this rule, the administration should compensate black farmers impacted by the USDA's past actions. It's no secret that black farmers were economically disadvantaged by the past intentional discrimination by USDA, Figures said in a statement. I believe this administration should take every opportunity to implement criteria to ensure that black farmers are not subjected to such treatment in the future. For Wright, a retired USDA employee who has worked with 10 presidents dating back to the 1960s, the label socially disadvantaged was never a good one because it included too many groups of people. He said black people haven't benefited from the wording as much as other people. Wright said while he doesn't believe preferential treatment should be given to a person because of race or sex, the government shouldn't deny a person resources for the same reason. I don't think I'm socially disadvantaged. I just happen to be black, and they discriminated against me because I'm black. So I think it's time that we straighten it out, he said. There are people who deserve compensation. I wouldn't call it reparations, but they deserve to be compensated for the damages done to them in the past by state, local, and federal governments, he added. Tiffany Belfil El-Amin, founder of the Kentucky Black Farmers Association, agrees that there needs to be a new definition because not all black people fit into the category of being disadvantaged. However, redefining the language of the policy is crucial to ensure that black farmers, who often receive limited resources, are adequately supported, she said. She pointed out that some black farmers with larger operations have been able to secure loans, even though they do not face disadvantages or discrimination. Additionally, she said that in some county offices, USDA officials prioritize outreach to white farmers, specifically those they are familiar with, leaving many black farmers to navigate the system on their own. The most prominent concern for Belfil El-Amin was the loss of inclusivity. That's why we adopt new ways of doing Underground Railroad type situations. We're going to figure it out one way or another, she said. We just don't have time to fight with definitions that may or may not help us in the long run, just exhaust us out even further, and we still end up here. The new policy comes in response to two executive orders issued earlier this year by Trump, which terminates any mandates or programs that support DEI. We are taking this aggressive, unprecedented action to eliminate discrimination in any form at USDA, Rollins said in a news release. It is simply wrong and contrary to the fundamental principle that all persons should be treated equally. There has also been ongoing pressure from white farmers who have demanded the administration address what they describe as reverse discrimination. Just last month, a conservative law firm sued the Trump administration on behalf of Adam Faust, a white dairy farmer from Wisconsin. Faust alleges that he has experienced discrimination in three USDA programs, Dairy Margin Coverage Program, Loan Guarantee Program, and Environmental Quality Incentives Program. He claims that the programs favor women and farmers of color, offering reduced administrative fees, higher loan guarantees, and more money for conservation efforts. In 2021, the farmer successfully sued Joe Biden's administration over similar claims. Faust, along with a group of white Midwestern farmers, argued that a $4 billion loan forgiveness program that would have helped farmers of color was unconstitutional because it discriminated against them. This suit was filed by the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, the same firm representing him in the current case. Meanwhile, black farmers are still suing for their due. Earlier this year, the Memphis, Tennessee-based Black Farmers and Agriculturalists Association brought a case to the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, alleging they were ineligible to apply for the Discrimination Financial Assistance Program. The program provided assistance to 43,000 farmers of all racial backgrounds who experienced discrimination prior to 2021. Raphael Warnock, a Democratic senator from Georgia who serves on the Senate Agriculture Committee, said that he pledges his support to help black farmers receive equitable resources. Instead of working to create more certainty for our nation's farmers in adopting a stable trade agenda, this administration is focused on divisive publicity stunts that will hurt our agriculture industry long term, Warnock said. Given the current political climate, Warnock isn't sure if he should see the glass as half empty or half full, but he remains pessimistic about this administration. However, he says this is an opportunity to get some things straightened out and implement a new definition. In some cases, they started to broaden the social disadvantage to include the historically underserved. And if you add it up, it was about 80% of the population, Wright said. He added, "We're going to have plenty of time to work on a new definition. You're not going to be able to get anything passed unless we get a different Congress and president, and you're really talking about the next administration at best. By then, we ought to be able to straighten it out." That was the article titled, "United States Department of Agriculture in Support for Black Farmers, Saying It Sufficiently Handled Discrimination." This appeared in the Guardian newspaper on July 22, 2025, and was written by Aaliyah Wright. I'm going to wrap up today's program with an article from the New Yorker magazine. The title is, "Mind the Gap: What We Get Wrong About Racial Wealth Disparities," written by Idris Kaloun. This was published in the August 4th, 2025 edition of the New Yorker magazine. In mathematics, you often have to deal with the problem of division by zero, an undefined gesture toward infinity. Charting the wealth gap between white and black Americans over time poses a similar problem. It's not that African Americans arrived with almost no property, it's that they arrived as property themselves. The whole calculation is a category error. For two centuries, first under British rule, then under an American flag that proclaimed liberty and justice for all, black people in the United States were enslaved. The Revolution's soaring promises of inalienable rights and universal equality were never meant to include them. It took a civil war before African Americans were finally recognized as citizens. Only after the abolition of slavery does it become possible to begin a meaningful statistical series, and what it reveals is a yawning chasm. Legal equality was written into the Constitution in 1868 in what historians sometimes call the nation's second founding, but the reality was more elusive. Reconstruction tumbled after Abraham Lincoln's assassination and soon collapsed altogether. The slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back toward slavery, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote. This new form of subjugation was less overt, but no less deliberate. Poll taxes and literacy tests stripped away suffrage. Sharecropping turned freedom into a kind of feudalism. Jim Crow laws imposed rigid segregation, and lynching enforced it with terror. Even those who headed north as part of the Great Migration in search of opportunity and relief found themselves corralled into ghettos. And yet, during this long and harrowing period of state-sanctioned exclusion, the chasm began to narrow. Elora de Rennencourt, an economist at Princeton, has documented this slow convergence. In 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, white Americans held 56 times the per capita wealth of black Americans. Within a decade, that ratio had been reduced to 23 to 1. By 1920, it was 10 to 1. By mid-century, it was 7 to 1. The crowning legislative victories of the Civil Rights era, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, came in the mid-1960s, a full century after emancipation. By then, the gap stood at roughly 6 to 1. At the apex of the Civil Rights Movement, after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, but before that of Martin Luther King Jr., it was clear that legal equality, though hard won, would not be enough. Cities remained rigidly segregated. The ghettos, now synonymous with concentrated poverty, simmered with unrest. In a 1965 article for Commentary, Bayard Rustin, the chief architect of the 1963 March on Washington, observed that the civil rights struggle was evolving into a full-fledged social movement, concerned not merely with removing the barriers to full opportunity, but with achieving the fact of equality. The trials that lay ahead, he warned, would be of far greater magnitude than the legal barriers that had just been torn down. The problems to surmount were structural, deindustrialization, entrenched segregation, economic marginalization, conditions shaped by Jim Crow, but not undone by its eclipse. To meet the challenge, Rustin, King, and A. Philip Randolph, the longtime leader of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, drafted a bold proposal called a Freedom Budget for All Americans. It was not a demand for reparations, nor was it framed explicitly in racial terms. Instead, it outlined a universalist expansion of the welfare state, grounded in the idea that economic justice could reinforce democratic citizenship. The budget's principles called for increased investment in health care and education, the elimination of slums and ghettos, and most ambitiously, a federal jobs guarantee. There would be, the men emphasized, no doles, no interference with private enterprise. The aim was only to give the poor a chance to become dignified wage earners. The Freedom Budget never became reality. What took shape instead were President Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty and the broader suite of Great Society programs. A sweeping expansion of the American welfare state, though one that stopped short of the jobs guarantee that Rustin, King, and Randolph had deemed essential. Still, for a moment, there was the potential for a national effort at economic redistribution, an effort that, unlike the New Deal, extended its benefits across racial lines. Franklin D. Roosevelt's legacy had left black Americans behind. Social Security was designed to exclude domestic and agricultural workers, the majority of the black labor force at the time. The newly formed Federal Housing Administration underwrote home loans that went overwhelmingly to white families. The GI Bill, heralded as a ladder to the middle class, was locally administered, allowing Southern officials to deny black veterans the benefits that their white counterparts received. Johnson's programs, by contrast, were meant to desegregate not just schools and lunch counters, but government assistance itself. In 1965, speaking at Howard University, the president laid out what he called the next and the more profound stage of the battle for civil rights, a fight for not just equality as a right and a theory, but equality as a fact and equality as a result. The metaphor that he used has since become canonical. You do not take a person who, for years, has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bring him up to the starting line of a race, and say, you are free to compete with all the others, and still justly believe that you have been completely fair. He didn't use the term affirmative action, but the policy began there, in elite universities and in companies with federal contracts, and would persist in one form or another for decades. 60 years on, after the expansion of the welfare state, after affirmative action, after the decline of legal segregation and the slow erosion of overt discrimination, you might expect the convergence to have continued. You might expect real economic parity to have come within reach. But the numbers tell a stranger story. The racial wealth gap today remains where it was in the 1960s, around 6-1. The ratio hasn't changed. What went wrong? Theories abound. One of the most persistent, and to many persuasive, is that racism never truly receded. It simply changed form. This is the core argument of The Plunder of Black America, How the Racial Wealth Gap Was Made, published by Yale, written by the historian Calvin Schermerhorn. The book traces the fortunes of 7 black families across generations, excavating genealogies and tabulating, with forensic care, the labor extracted and the property lost. The result is a long historical arc of dispossession that culminates in a bracing indictment. A nation founded, in large part, on ransacking African Americans' work product, never gave up stealing. The last 100 years have been a nimble shift in that theft and wealth stripping. Intentional racism became an institutional reflex. In this account, every apparent step forward is matched by a quiet reversion, each gain followed by a new, more elusive form of loss. Redlining gives way to predatory inclusion through subprime loans. School desegregation in the city sparks white flight to the suburbs. The election of Barack Obama is answered by the rise of Donald Trump. Again and again, advancement is met with backlash, recognition by retrenchment. The diagnosis echoes the dark realism of early critical race theorists. Black people will never gain full equality in this country, the legal scholar Derrick Bell wrote in his classic, Faces at the Bottom of the Well, from 1992. Even those Herculean efforts we hail as successful will produce no more than temporary peaks of progress, short-lived victories that slide into irrelevance as racial patterns adapt in ways that maintain white dominance. The permanent racism hypothesis offers a compelling account for all the progress we haven't seen. What it can't readily explain is the progress we have seen. Since 1970, the share of black children living in poverty has fallen from 56% to 16%, according to researchers at Columbia University's Center on Poverty and Social Policy, an improvement attributable largely to the welfare architecture begun during the Johnson era. Residential segregation, too, has declined. The sociologists John Logan and Brian J. Stultz, analyzing every decennial census from 1980 to 2020, found significant drops in black-white segregation across American cities. Notably, the five most segregated metro areas today, Newark, Milwaukee, Detroit, New York, and Chicago, are all north of the Mason-Dixon line. Not all the data are encouraging. The economists Ross Chetty and Nathaniel Hendren, mining income tax records to track 20 million children into adulthood, have shown that black children face much higher rates of downward mobility than white children born at the same income level. Yet, even here, the pattern is not monolithic. The gap is almost entirely driven by black boys. Black girls and white girls raised in similar economic circumstances show no meaningful differences in mobility. These complexities pose problems for the permanent racism thesis. If the racial wealth gap is a straightforward product of systemic racism, how did it narrow during the height of Jim Crow, when racism was overt and institutionalized and stalled out after those structures were formally dismantled? Why is the mobility story for black women so different from that for black men? And why have other marginalized groups, Asian Americans and Hispanics among them, managed to accumulate wealth at a faster rate, despite their own histories of exclusion and discrimination? History paints a vivid picture, but without economic rigor, it risks missing the frame. One might have hoped for a more searching explanation in Black Power Scorecard, Measuring the Racial Gap and What We Can Do to Close It, published by Metropolitan, a recent book by the Brookings scholar Andre M. Perry. There is at least some nod here to underlying causes of the racial wealth gap, differences in family formation and educational attainment. But the analysis is often hasty and uneven. Perry repeatedly asserts that the thinking that education predicts wealth is misguided, because wealth predicts education. There is, no doubt, a strong correlation between family wealth and educational attainment. But one of the most consistently replicated findings in economics is that, even accounting for wealth, higher education itself leads to higher earnings. College graduates now earn, on average, at least 80% more than those without degrees. To claim, as Perry does, that education is not the great equalizer, at a time when a significant racial gap in college completion persists, risks doing real harm. His reluctance to treat family structure as a casual factor is similarly puzzling. He notes that married black households have an average wealth of $230,000, more than three times that of their unmarried peers, but resists drawing the obvious conclusion. The gap is not merely about differences in saving habits. Perry acknowledges that 57% of black children do not live with their fathers, but hurries past the long-term consequences of that fact. A growing body of research in child psychology and economics links adverse childhood experiences, violence, instability, parental absence, to poor performance in school, reduced emotional well-being, and lower lifetime earnings. In a paper titled The Trouble with Boys, The economists Marianne Bertrand and Jessica Pond find that boys in particular suffer more acutely. They are more likely to act out, fall behind, and fail to recover. Perry concedes that there are no economic benefits to marriage, but cautions that focusing on it diverts attention from eliminating the discrimination that extracts wealth and makes marriage less likely. As with education, he treats wealth not as an outcome, but as a precondition. Having decided that wealth disparity is the foundational cause of all others, Perry presents a remedy that's scaled accordingly, a reparations program that could cost as much as $14 trillion. The proposal comes with a handful of other guarantees to Black Americans. What is owed, he writes, includes lower energy bills, facilitated in part by the installation of programmable thermostats, and a single-payer system that provides universal care without significant cost-sharing. There are, to be sure, books on the subject that offer more rigor and depth. The Color of Money, Black Banks and the Racial Wealth Gap, published in 2017 by Marsha Baradaran, a law professor at the University of California, Irvine, is a sharp, historically grounded critique of the idea that segregated institutions, Black banks in particular, ever meaningfully close the racial wealth gap. Black economic power and autonomy had a natural appeal in the face of segregation and racism, she writes. But the strategy has been an anemic response to racial inequality and has yielded virtually nothing in terms of long-term convergence. Economic power, she argues, cannot thrive in isolation. Bank of America, she notes, began as the Bank of Italy, serving working-class Italian immigrants in San Francisco, its eventual success made possible by integration into the broader financial system. Full racial integration will eventually remove pockets of blight, crime, and deprivation across the country, Baradaran writes. We must shed the destructive myths that separate can be equal, that a segregated economy will reach prosperity on its own. Baradaran, like many others, ultimately endorses reparations, including in the form of direct cash payments. A similar line of reasoning appears in the legal scholar Bernadette Atuahene's new book, Plundered, How Racist Policies Undermine Black Homeownership in America, published by Little Brown. Drawing on legal analysis and deep ethnographic work, Atuahene investigates a quietly devastating episode in Detroit, the city's illegal overassessment of property taxes in the years following the 2008 financial crisis. Thousands of poor Black homeowners, many living in the only properties they had ever owned or stood to pass down, were driven into foreclosure. The result was a deepening of the already stark wealth divide between Black residents of the city and white residents of the surrounding suburbs. Atuahene adopts a definition of racism in the mode of Ibram X. Kendi's, any policy or practice that sustains racial inequality. Though her study focuses on a single city, she insists that predatory governance is an American problem, one that operates quietly, bureaucratically, and often legally across jurisdictions. Unless these policies are exposed and eradicated, she warns, the wealth gap will continue to fester, unnoticed but widening all the same. If you take these diagnoses seriously, reading them from the vantage of our current political moment is enough to invite despondency. Reparations, long proposed as the only measure proportionate to the scale of racial plunder, look increasingly like a political, economic, and legal non-starter. Donald Trump, now returned to the presidency, would never sign such a bill. Republicans in Congress would never pass one. Even California, a wealthy blue state with a Democratic supermajority in the legislature, is balking at the anticipated cost of state-level reparations. The conservative majority on the Supreme Court, for its part, regards the Constitution as colorblind, an understanding that leaves little room for policies explicitly tied to race. Even a groundswell of political will seems unlikely to sweep these obstacles aside. In 2020, America underwent what many called a racial reckoning, sparked by the mass protest organized under the Black Lives Matter banner. But the efforts in retrospect feel ephemeral. Many police departments that saw their budget slashed have had those funds hastily restored amid a rise in violent crime. Corporate pledges to meet diversity targets and back diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives have, in many cases, been quietly shelved or publicly reversed in deference to shifting political winds. Joe Biden, elected in 2020 on a platform that stressed racial equity, made little progress on that front. Trump was not merely reelected in 2024, he won the popular vote outright and doubled his support among black voters, winning 16%. One begins to understand why pessimism has always been the shadow companion of critical race theory. Other perspectives from the social sciences offer more room for hope. William Julius Wilson, an eminent sociologist at Harvard, has long argued that the persistence of black economic disadvantage is not solely a function of present-day racism, but also the result of large-scale economic transformations that, while not racially motivated, have had racially disparate effects. The decline of American manufacturing, the rise of globalization, the shift towards a service-based economy that disproportionately rewards college graduates have all contributed to the stratification we now see. To ignore these structural forces, Wilson suggests, is to misdiagnose the problem and to risk prescribing the wrong solutions. Elora Durenicourt, the economist whose work traces the racial wealth gap back to 1860, has long studied why progress stalled in the past 60 years. Along with colleagues, she identifies three reasons. First, income convergence between black and white Americans largely halted. Second, black wealth is held disproportionately in housing rather than in financial assets or businesses, meaning that stock market booms, which have become a hallmark of the post-Reagan economy, widen rather than shrink the gap. Third, a persistent savings gap between black and white households compounds over time. According to their models, unless those underlying conditions are addressed, even reparations on a vast scale would offer only temporary relief. Within the next 30 years, they write, this gap would increase by 30%, and divergence would continue over time. A separate study, published by the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, sees a similar conclusion. Analyzing returns on capital intergenerational transfers and wage trajectories, the study's authors find that equalizing earnings is by far the most important mechanism for permanently closing the racial wealth gap. They also test the effects of a direct redistribution, basically a helicopter drop of wealth. The result? Equalizing wealth without changing the earnings gap has no long-term effect on the wealth gap. These findings complicate the dominant narrative that has taken shape in the past decade, that the black-white wealth gap, built on a foundation of historical injustice, serves as a kind of permanent sentence. This view, widely circulated in works like Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Case for Reparations, published in The Atlantic in 2014, Richard Rosenstein's best-selling book, The Color of Law, from 2017, and the New York Times Magazine's 1619 Project, launched in 2019, holds that past policies of exclusion and dispossession, especially in housing, created a self-perpetuating cycle of inequality, which can be broken only through proportionate intervention. The taproot of this story is often identified with the infamous redlining maps created by the Homeowners Loan Corporation, or HOL, a New Deal agency established in 1933. According to this account, HOLC maps codified residential segregation, denying African Americans access to home loans and, in turn, the chance to accumulate generational wealth through property ownership. The solution in this framework is remedial state action commensurate with the original harm. But the historical record isn't so clear-cut. The HOLC maps were not widely disseminated at the time, and the agency itself was relatively equitable in its lending. It was the Federal Housing Administration, established a year later, that proved more systematically discriminatory, encouraging lenders to use racial covenants and steering loans toward white-only suburbs. Still, during the 33 years between the founding of HOLC and the passage of the Fair Housing Act in 1968, the black-white wealth gap continued to diminish. Moreover, redlining was not uniquely applied to black neighborhoods. Many of the areas assigned the worst rating, D for hazardous, were filled with recent immigrants of Italian, Slavic, or Jewish origin. In a review of HOLC maps across seven cities, the urbanologist Alan Malott found that at the time they were drawn, the vast majority of residents of redlined areas were white ethnics. These communities faced discrimination and hardship, yet many of their children outpaced their parents economically. Recent work by the economists Leah Bustan and Ron Opromisky shows that this pattern of upward mobility continues among the children of immigrants today, including those from poor countries like Guatemala and El Salvador. The contrast is telling. In 2007, black and Hispanic families had roughly the same levels of median wealth. 15 years later, Hispanic wealth had doubled. Black wealth had risen only by half. A rejoinder to the project of decomposing the racial wealth gap into its constituent parts, the marriage gap, the business ownership gap, the education gap, the income gap, is that each of these two is a reflection of racism, both past and present. To search for colorblind remedies is therefore a fool's errand. As a theory of history, this is powerful. As a guide to policy, however, it's frustratingly limited. Take education, one of the most powerful predictors of income. There is no question that separate and unequal schooling created vast disparities in educational attainment. But when today's racial achievement gaps are attributed to more nebulous forms of discrimination, like implicit bias and standardized testing, the explanatory force begins to wane. The solutions that many voices for racial justice have espoused tend to be moral or psychological in nature. Decolonizing curricula, re-educating teachers, raising public awareness of structural inequity. These measures are often abstract and resistant to scale, let alone rigorous evaluation. Consider instead the possibility that many of the racial achievement gaps we observe today reflect not only race, but class. The reality that American society is increasingly divided into islands of affluence and disadvantage. The evidence for this is growing. Childhood exposure to concentrated poverty has lasting effects across time and across racial categories. It hinders cognitive development, educational attainment, and long-term earnings. These forces shape the lives of children on the South Side of Chicago and in Appalachian. These forces shape the lives of children on the South Side of Chicago and in Appalachian Hollows, in Native reservations and in borderland colonias alike. And if concentrated poverty damages all children, then deconcentrating and reducing it should benefit all children. The means for doing so are already known. Expanding direct cash supports, such as child tax credits, has demonstrable effects, and even figures like Vice President J.D. Vance have endorsed this. So does integrating neighborhoods, something that's within the grasp of the politicians who run big American cities. But doing so would require loosening the zoning restrictions that choke new housing construction and untangling the web of air rights, environmental reviews, noise ordinances, and traffic studies, which keeps poor families pinned in place. It would require something far less poetic than a moral awakening, just a shift in what kinds of barriers we choose to take down. It might seem almost too obvious to say that the wealth gap is, at bottom, an income gap, but that simple reframing clarifies a great deal. Wealth is a terminal indicator. It reflects not only the inheritance one starts with, but the sum of a lifetime's earnings, net of taxes and consumption. Yearly income differences, when compounded over decades, become chasms of accumulated capital. The well-off don't just save money, they save differently. They move beyond housing into equities, retirement accounts, and business ownership, forms of wealth that, on average, grow faster than a home can appreciate. For families with lower incomes, that leap is rarely possible. It is also more plausible practically and politically to break the chain of intergenerational poverty. An absence of income, which necessarily leads to an absence of wealth, than it is to forcibly level wealth itself. And we know more than ever about how to do this. Chetty, the economist, along with his collaborators, has identified features of neighborhoods that give poor children the best shot at upward mobility. Five stand out. Low levels of residential segregation, low levels of income inequality, good schools, strong social capital, and high levels of family stability. Of course, there is little reason to expect the current administration to turn its attention toward the elimination of child poverty or the narrowing of racial income gaps. But it does at least profess concerns for the fortunes of working-class Americans. There's a faint rhyme between the newly created Trump accounts, which will provide newborns in the United States with $1,000, and the progressive idea of baby bonds, investment accounts designed to grow over time into modest stores of capital. The reality, though, is that explicitly race-conscious strategies for economic convergence are off the table. Affirmative action has been thrown out in college admissions and hiring. Civil rights law, for the foreseeable future, will be interpreted through the lens of constitutional colorblindness. The equity-oriented initiatives of the Biden administration are already being reversed. Even on the left, the appetite for social justice rhetoric has cooled. There was political wisdom in the design of the freedom budget that A. Philip Randolph, Bayard Rustin, and Martin Luther King Jr. proposed a half century ago. Its benefits were meant to reach all Americans. Today, that wisdom is no longer optional. It is the only path left. That was the article titled, Mind the Gap: What We Got Wrong About Racial Wealth Disparities. It was written by Idris Calhoun and published in the August 4th, 2025 edition of The New Yorker Magazine. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.